This week on Living at the Barricades, we will discuss the provincial approval of a plan to build 86 wind towers on Wolf Island, the largest of the Thousand Islands, but also we'll probe, why did the province ignore recommendations for re-siting individual towers? Why did the Minister of Environment disqualify himself from public recommendations and expert evidence consideration? Why was the company and its engineers treated like friends, while the public like enemies? Why did the province not even try to protect bird habitat and natural features on Wolf Island? We will also talk about this and so much more, so hold on.
This is Living at the Barricades, CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, and Welcome 92.7 FM Trent Radio.
The rights of people to eat fish have been taken away from them. Mercury-emitting stacks play a large role in that.
It's so great to think that one day we're going to be able to turn the clock and restore a river.
You know, the river valley, the Ganaraska River area, and a very strong affiliation with the environment. When I came to know about the contamination.
It's almost impossible to divorce a community from its waterfront.
They're so worried about offending their neighbors that they just end up offending their children because of the environmental burden that we're leaving our children.
Now is the time to create policies that help reverse the trends of the past. Now is the time.
Welcome to Living at the Barricades. I'm your co-host, Kristen Tully, Vice President of Lake Ontario Waterkeeper.
And I'm Mark Mattson, President of Lake Ontario Waterkeeper.
This week, the province of Ontario approved the provincial environmental assessment, or a form of environmental assessment, for the Wolf Island Wind Project. Essentially, a director had given its approval for the Wolf Island Wind Project. That's 86 turbines being built in important bird habitat on the eastern end of Lake Ontario. Lake Ontario Waterkeeper, along with some local citizens and grassroots organizations, had appealed the director's decision. We appealed to the Minister of the Environment, and then at the 11th hour, he recused himself from the decision-making process, claiming there may be a conflict of interest, there may be the appearance of bias. And so before Waterkeeper was even officially notified that the Minister of the Environment would no longer be the decision-maker, the Minister of Tourism approved the Wolf Island Wind Project. That's the provincial approval. There's still a federal environmental assessment process underway.
And make no doubt about it, we've all heard the words renewable power, green power, sustainable power, and everybody wants these things for our community. They mean clean air, clean water, clean fish, and they mean healthy, strong communities. But it's not just words. It takes more than words to get to the sustainable, green, renewable future. It requires study. It requires action. It requires oversight. It requires public participation. It's hard work to get at these things, and you need to try your best. In Ontario, for centuries now, we've been setting out plans for our electricity grid. We'll build a nuke plant, we'll build a coal plant, we'll double up a hydro dam, and we always had the answers. And then what we do is we try and design a process to support those answers. Well, not only are we going to get greener power, but we have to change the way we make these decisions. We have to have the process first and let the science and the people and the recommendations that come out of that process become the undertaking in terms and conditions that make sure that that's what the project it is. We can't make this the end should justify the means. The means is an important part of arriving at a sustainable green end.
So just to backtrack for a second, especially for our new listeners on Trent Radio, 92.7 FM, Lake Ontario Waterkeeper has been involved in the Wolf Island Wind Project for over a year now, and we got involved at the request of local residents who were concerned about potential environmental impacts, not of wind turbines in general or of the project as a whole, but of a specific number of wind turbines located in a particularly sensitive part of Wolf Island. So our involvement in the process was limited to protecting important bird habitat and protecting fish and fish habitat. We put forward a number of recommendations, including alternative locations for some of the wind turbines. We asked for mediation. We asked for a full environmental assessment, a proper environmental assessment, rather than the review report that the Canadian hydro developers was doing at the time. And the province didn't really respond to any of our recommendations. And just at the end, when the approval was given, we got copies of some documents that the province had based its decision on, and we found out that the public's participation had actually been completely misrepresented, and that was a really big problem for us. Here we had organizations like WIRE who had gone out, they'd hired independent experts to do evaluations of the potential impacts of these specific turbines on bird and bird habitat. We had real evidence from these experts saying that there was an environmental concern. We were backed up by Environment Canada, and what we asked for was a mediation process, just to make sure that when green power is built, the environment is still protected. And that goes back to what you were saying, Mark, about the idea that just because something is clean power, there's no carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, greenhouse gas emissions, there's no radio nuclides emissions, there's no nuclear impact. So we're totally supportive of this project going forward. We believe it's green power. But at the same time, we want to make sure that the decision-making process ensures that the specific community's needs are protected. And we talked to Chris Brown, musician and activist on Wolf Island, about some of his concerns.
I've been incredulous about the whole process. It's been secretive, completely fantastical in terms of what they tell us versus internal memos that you see going to the government. It's without precedent. I mean, standard order of affairs these days for wind turbines is 1 per square kilometer. We're seeing 86 on 7 square kilometers. I mean, it's just a trashing of the landmass. It sets very bad precedent, and it forebodes bad things for the industry in the country, because if it's not done right, this what is to us nascent technology is really put in jeopardy by greed. It hasn't been fair in the least. They optioned land. They signed clandestine agreements with landowners before there was any form of assessment, any sightings done, to the point where any critical thought then means, well, you're taking money out of farmers' hands. Well, people should not be put in opposition like that.
An article by Dave Bedini back in November last year really hit the nail on the head as it related to Waterkeeper. We went into the Wolf Island community, and we really spoke to that community about these incredible and fantastic environmental processes that are out there that these community members would be able to take advantage of in order to protect Wolf Island, something that was very dear to them. And it's very dear not just to the people of Wolf Island. It is a globally significant bird habitat. It's dear to the people of the Thousand Islands, the people on Lake Ontario, provincially, internationally. And I think what hurts most, listening to Chris and listening to others on Wolf Island who watched this process, and Dave hit it on the head, which was, is that, you know, we were treated really poorly by the provincial government in this process. The ideas that went forward were not radical. There was no effort to undermine the overall project. Everything was intended to improve the project, to make this project better. And at the end of the day, we were treated as enemies, almost like we had leprosy and we were put in some little camp somewhere, while the Stantec, multinational engineering company, Canadian Renewable Energy Corp, they were treated like they were the best friends of the regulator, and we were treated like enemies. And I think the Globe picked, or the Whig Standard again, picked up on that yesterday.
Yeah, there was an editorial in the Kingston Whig Standard earlier this week talking about the idea of the bias and the conflict of interest. And I guess what's been really frustrating throughout the process, both for Waterkeeper and for the residents on the island, is this idea that if you have a criticism, or if you have an idea about how to improve something or make it better, or any form of dissent in any way, that the government is actually treating you as if you're some kind of enemy, that somehow criticizing a project or putting forward ideas, trying to improve something or thinking a little more creatively or thinking outside the box, you're going to get treated like you don't belong in the room, that you shouldn't be there at the decision-making table because you don't already agree with everything that's being said, or that if you think that you want to move 6 wind turbines in order to protect bird habitat, you're not a real environmentalist because you're not supporting green power anymore.
And then that feeling really came through in the final days here last week when the Minister of Environment, Minister Gerritsen, stepped down, didn't consider it. There were 15 people, and there was a lot of pages and evidence that went into the minister really looking for a real review of the director's decision. And it went to the Minister of Tourism, and within 3 days he made a decision basically ignoring everything we had said, everything the community had said, and basically throwing the company's talking points back at us as though this was going to placate or make us feel like we were somehow involved in the process, but we were just wrong. And anybody who can read that, you just feel like we were being managed, manipulated, pushed around, and it's going to be hard. Although, you know, we will do it, but it's hard to speak to the people the importance of these processes and how much they need to put their faith in it when we've really reached a new low in Ontario as it relates to environmental processes because of this process in particular. I don't know if we want to get into some of the specifics, but I recall this summer we were at the Ontario Municipal Board hearing. They had this little holding pattern over the environmental review report. It wasn't even on the table. It wasn't released to the public. And we're having a hearing to rezone the whole island for wind turbines. And even today, the federal environmental process, which the provinces, it says, will determine cumulative impacts and will look into post-monitoring control and construction impacts, it hasn't even started. And yet we know the turbines are showing up. We know the company says they're going ahead with it next week. We know the cement kiln applications are all in the process. And yet we haven't even been asked to comment federally yet. It's just really disheartening.
Well, and the idea that the ends don't always justify the means, and that there should be some sort of fairness and the feeling of fairness and a commitment to fairness in a decision-making process is not new. It's something that's, you know, it's a legal principle, natural justice. It goes back hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years. And so, because it's difficult to get past our own outrage and our own frustration to speak rationally about this, we went to one of the leading experts in Canada on fair decision-making. That's Professor Roderick MacDonald.
He's a professor of constitutional and public law at McGill University in Montreal, and he teaches and publishes in the areas of civil law, commerce law, administrative law, constitutional law, and jurisprudence.
And so the first thing that we asked him is, what is meant by procedural fairness? What are we talking about?
Issues of transparency, advance notice, opportunity to participate, opportunity to know what is actually up for decision, are important in rulemaking processes, in legislative processes, so that frequently what happens is that municipal councils and other decision makers say, well, we're not adjudicating rights, so we don't have to worry about procedural fairness, which is just so wrong. And that's I think that's an important point for all of us working in the environmental field to keep constantly reminding decision makers that open government means open all the way down and as early in the process as possible.
And we also talked to Professor MacDonald about environmental approval processes that make the environment an afterthought, something that really politicians or regulators consider at the end of the decision-making process as opposed to at the beginning.
What often happens, as we have discovered with a number of our hearings before the Public Hearings Board in Quebec in environmental matters, is that an issue which has significant environmental impact is characterized as an issue of public health, or it's characterized as an issue of energy, or it's characterized as an issue of tourism, and long planning has gone into it in other ministries without considering environmental impact, and therefore, by the time you get around to an environmental hearing, you're already months, if not years, and many dollars expended into a process, and it's awfully hard to back off. So one of the key things is to get every ministry and every decision-making body to ask, almost as a best practices protocol, what are the environmental consequences of X? And to have to sign off on those before you can get to step two of the deliberative process. And it's rare today that you're going to find any public decision process that doesn't have environmental consequences, which means from the get-go, the environment will be there and be heard. At this stage, the first and important issue is a general sensitivity to political decision on the part of political decision makers, that little that they do doesn't have environmental consequences. In other words, their sensitivity to the process means that they are going to begin getting input right from the beginning, and somebody's going to say, but by the way, did you realize that that this will have an impact on migratory patterns of birds? And Who would have thought of that? Your average politician is not going to think about that, because if anything, when that person thinks environment, they will think, well, am I going to, you know, open a quarry, or am I going to cut down a forest? And if it looks like it's just a field, these wouldn't normally come to their attention. Mm-hmm. You have to get a protocol in there so that people have an opportunity to raise the whole range of environmental issues right from the outset.
And I think Professor McDonald, he hits on an incredibly important point right there. Most decisions that we make have environmental consequences. We can't separate environmental issues from non-environmental issues. I ran up against that when I was speaking to the Standing Committee at the House of Commons on transportation issues, where they were trying to somehow separate navigation and Navigable Waters Protection Act from other issues like fish habitat, clean water, that kind of thing. So Professor McDonald makes that link between environmental issues and other decisions that are being made. And he also makes that important point that environmental decision-making is not somehow a second-class process to other decision-makings. Protecting birds and bird habitat and clean air and clean water is not somehow less important than protecting property values or other policy planning issues that government may be involved in, that industry may be involved in. And that this whole idea that we're going to make all the decisions, we're going to go through all this process, we're going to talk about where we want to put wind turbines or where we want to put an ethanol facility in the case of the Oshawa Harbor, where we want to put a highway in the case of Hamilton, and then we'll just ram through the environmental stuff at the very end as if somehow the outcome is guaranteed. And I think that is a disservice to the process. The public participates in good faith. They go in there, they're trying to make the projects better. They're trying to make their communities better. They could be boycotting the hearings. They could be outside protesting in the streets or demonstrating. Instead, they're buying into the idea that if they participate in good faith, their community will be stronger than it was before. And it's the government in this case that's somehow saying, you know what, don't worry about the federal environmental assessment process. You're going to get that license. Let's just assume that the outcome is guaranteed. And it's this idea that government and industry don't have to assume any risk whatsoever. They're going to get what they want when they want it, no matter how they're going to get it, and that the community is the one who's taking on all the risks for all these projects, whether or not it's going to go forward, whether or not they're going to have to give up habitat or clean air or clean water just to protect somebody else.
Taking all the risks and in this case, spending a lot of money on experts and bringing it forward in good faith, and maybe the added element of this process that, you know, I should be more aware of, I know some of the changes have been in the works for a while, but I never really experienced it like I did here, was the absence of even having the government at the table, and that we were dealing with the self-assessment process, that is, where the engineer company took our comments. The engineer company that was hired by the proponent in this case acted as though they were the decision makers, they were the middlemen, they would hear our comments and they would make the decision. And we were, you know, in terms of Professor McDonald and what he's saying, the government was not only not doing their job, they were almost hiding somewhere and leaving it to this engineer company to do their job for them.
Yeah, for anybody that hasn't participated in a process like this before, the way that it's happening more and more is that we weren't even making our submissions or giving our evidence to the official government decision makers. We were giving our evidence, expert evidence, evidence that would stand up on a witness stand, to a consulting company that was hired by the proponent to interpret our concerns and then in turn relay that information in their own words to the decision maker. And the feeling of unfairness and the idea that somehow we were outsiders coming into the process is entrenched in that formula. And so, again, that divides the community from the proponent, from the government, and makes it an us versus them, an issue, a good guys versus bad guys, a proponent versus opponent. And it's almost impossible to make good decisions that way. And Professor McDonald talked about that as well.
We're talking about processes, and I think a very important issue is to help decision makers realize that public participation and information and input is most valuable as early in the process as possible as you can get it. That very often in a deliberative process, you find yourself locked into a path dependency type of situation, and a number of doors and options are foreclosed before you even get to the point of soliciting public input. And therefore, when you're imagining a participatory process, you really have to invite public participation right from the get-go. And it's not enough just to advertise the possibility of participation. Genuine consultation means going out and soliciting information, taking proactive steps to imagine all potentially affected constituencies and get them in and get their ideas and insight into the process as soon as possible. I would say that once you get deeper into a process, and I've spent a lot of my life, unfortunately, I suppose, doing these kinds of decisions, it's a natural human condition to believe that if somebody is raising a concern about your project, it's because they're against you. And it's because you think you've thought through all the possibilities. It's a normal human instinct, and you've come to the best decision. So part of what's required is, and we used to do some training like this in Quebec, helping public officials realize, and this includes elected officials, realize that when people raise issues around a project, it's not to be obstreperous. It's not to sink their project. It's not to tell them that they're stupid or insensitive. It's to help them, in their role as trustee for the public interest, come to the most informed and richest and most complete decision possible. In other words, the idea of a consultation is to imagine the consultee as a part of the process, as part of the information process, as a part of the let's see the big picture, rather than to see them as oppositional and adversarial. And that's a change in ethic of decision making, which is absolutely required but awfully hard to generate.
The message here to the government and to everyone out there and to all environmental groups as well is if you want a green, renewable, sustainable future, you've got to try a little harder.
And that's Janis Joplin. Try a little harder here on Living at the Barricades, broadcasting on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, 92.7 FM Trent Radio in Peterborough, and podcasting worldwide at waterkeeper.ca and on iTunes. And you've got a very special opportunity from now until September 14th to support Lake Ontario Waterkeeper with the help of the Jack Johnson Ohana Charitable Foundation, who has offered to match every dollar Waterkeeper is able to raise through its all-at-once match. So please go to waterkeeper.ca if you'd like to make a donation online, and simply write in all at once in the memo line, and same goes for sending in a check to our office. And we're back here in studio with hosts Mark Mattson and Kristen Tully.
Now, no thanks to the government or the proponent or their engineers in this process, but there were some good things that we have been able to take away from this process. We've learned a lot, although the process was a very poor process. We did learn a lot, and there's some news coming out of this that is going to be, you know, I think, protective of the Great Lakes and the areas around Wolf Island as it relates to green power and windmills in the future.
Yeah, certainly through the help of our experts and the experts that WIRE commissioned, we've learned a lot about how wind turbines can impact birds and bird habitat, and what simple steps can be taken to make sure that those negative impacts or the consequences don't happen, especially in water areas. That's something that not a lot of people knew about before, is the difference between putting a wind turbine in a grassy field where there's no water to be found and putting it in the middle of a major migratory pathway on the Great Lakes.
We learned a lot about what the real impacts on birds are. As you know, many people just think of it as birds being chopped down in the air as they're flying through the turbines. But of course, we learned it's the industrialization in these large, huge facilities in their habitat that scares them away. And if they don't have, you know, replaceable or alternative habitat, suitable habitat on their migratory routes.
Well, and on Lake Ontario, that's a particularly important issue. We've already lost 80% of our wetlands. Bird habitat is disappearing from the Lake Ontario watershed. So these birds and this fish that could be impacted by the project have nowhere else to go. There are no alternatives. And so the mitigation is especially important in areas that have already been jeopardized by development, habitat loss, and pollution, like Lake Ontario.
We also learned that the Ontario Power Authority, and in conjunction with OPG, the Ontario Power Generating Company, they did commission a study by Helimax, and Helimax has, after looking at the science, has decided that important bird areas, which Wolf Island is, as we say, one of the highest levels and most important bird areas, will no longer be considered suitable for siting windmills. One of the, I think, fallouts from that has been the end of really the idea that they're going to put more wind turbines and towers across Amherst Island, which is across Wolf Island. And finally, Dave Dempsey, we've had him on our show a couple times, I believe, and he's out of Michigan, and he's working on these really cool rules that he'd like to see all the Great Lakes adopt with respect to wind tower and turbines, because he's very he's very supportive of their development in the future of wind power on the Great Lakes. But he'd like to see, for example, that all towers are set back three miles from where the shore meets the water.
So that's all fantastic news. Again, it's really difficult because on the one hand, this whole process has been so crazy. It doesn't bear the hallmarks of fairness by any standard. The decision caught us completely by surprise because we really did expect, the solution was so easy. It wouldn't have cost anybody that much money or that much time. And so we were really surprised that the province of Ontario didn't take environmental protection more seriously and didn't really take into consideration any of our expert evidence. But at the same time, we don't want people to get cynical or discouraged about the process or think that it doesn't work or that it can't work, because it should work. It's supposed to work. That's what Waterkeeper is all about. And so with that in mind, the federal environmental assessment process, as I mentioned earlier, is just starting. Public consultation hasn't happened yet. I can't imagine that they would not allow for public consultation when the project has been so controversial and when our evidence is so strong. So that process is just getting started, and we're looking forward to that, improving the project in any way that we can again. And also, Lafarge has applied for air and water permits in order to make the concrete to build the turbines. So we want to make sure that those permits are protective of fish and fish habitat in the bays around Wolf Island, and that there aren't any air quality or dust issues associated with the concrete.
And I expect Lake Ontario Waterkeeper to be around during the whole 20-year commitment of with this project in Wolf Island, and we'll be following it up to make sure all the promises and all the commitments are met by the company, and make sure the government for accepting those commitments is there as well, working with us to make sure that they are met.
And then on other issues, we will be in Oshawa on Monday night. There's a committee meeting at General Motors Place about the proposed ethanol plant for the Oshawa Harborfront. And then our concerns for that are really just siting, wanting to make sure that one of the last green spaces in the Oshawa Harborfront area is protected. And welcome again to Trent Radio 92.7 FM. They're joining us this week, and they will be broadcasting Living at the Barricades every Saturday from 7 to 7:30 p.m. And that's all the time that we have. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, and thanks. I'm very cool to Trent. Hope we'll get up there and see everyone soon. I know Joseph Boyden said to say hi to everyone there. I know you have to read his book as part of your curriculum. So thanks, everyone, for being part this week of the Fistfight to Save the Planet. We'll see you next week, Living at the Barricades.